how this works for you. And I've entitled this talk, we're looking at empowered people. You are the empowered people, and empowered to do three things that have sort of come to our mind, really, when it comes to being missional, Roy Crown and I and a number of others. And we feel like we want to be empowered to speak, to give, and to be invitational. And these are three kind of areas that are important for us in creating a rhythm of mission inside our churches, that every one of us has a confidence when appropriate and in the right place to be able to share our faith in the context of Colossians 4, which is to be gracious, seasoned with a little salt. That we are empowered to give of ourselves in friendship, in service, but also to give appropriate things, books, materials. And we are empowered to be invitational. So it becomes a part of our lives just to invite people into our homes, into our churches, into situations that surround us. So these three characteristics become a part of us as people, and our church, as it were, creates infrastructure around these three things. So let's kind of look at these three things to start with, and then we'll look at the kind of the rhythm as far as the church is concerned and what this may or may not look like. So we're empowered to speak, and we've kind of worked our way through this. We're thinking of language, we're thinking of being gracious, we're thinking of salt, and we're thinking the mechanics of how we actually do this, how we have conversations. And I probably don't need to teach you this, but I will teach you it anyway, that in a sense we kind of need to reintroduce ourselves to the art of conversation. And when that we're involved with people, one of the things I think has done us no favors historically is we impose the gospel on people, and in a sense we don't have permission. And so they often come away from a conversation or an encounter feeling somewhat put on. And that can be even in the context of coming to us for help. So they come to us for help, be it a food bank or whatever, and suddenly find they're being preached at. And actually they didn't come to be preached at, they came to get food. And therefore they feel somewhat imposed upon and somewhat kind of, well, why did that happen to me? So I think one of the things that we have to kind of work into being gracious is realizing that we don't want to kind of be violating people's choices. We don't want to kind of be imposing on people. But we want to kind of treat them with respect, and yet we want to speak when appropriate. So we've got to kind of think of how we're going to do this. And for me, this is all about choices and offering invitations, so that we're thinking that if we encounter someone here, there's a choice gate and we can invite them to something else where there may be some content. But this choice gate's very important and we can invite them in. But obviously they can invite us in as well. So we can invite them, but they can invite us by asking questions. So they might have indeed come to a food bank, or they might be your mate and they ask you a question. Well, that's a reverse invitation. They are inviting you to talk. So we call this conversational tennis. So let me play conversational tennis with somebody. Your name is Anna. Anna. So I bump into Anna. She could be a friend, could be at a food bank, could be anything. And you need this, Anna. This represents a tennis ball. It's not a tennis ball, but just in your imagination, it can be a tennis ball for this point. And Anna asks me a question. So you can ask me any question you like about faith. There you go. So, good question. So, Anna gives me the tennis ball. I answer the question. I give the tennis ball back to Anna or Hannah? I'm better. Anna. And Anna may or may not ask me another question. So as long as she's asking me questions, I'm answering them. The moment she stops asking me questions, I stop talking. Because at that point, she has removed permission. She's got the tennis ball. She hasn't knocked it back over the net. So now we talk about something else. So in this kind of simple form of dialogue, I have responded to her. I've said what I need to say. And she has asked as many questions as she wants to ask. And at some point in the process, enough's enough, she stops. She remains in charge of the process. Now, I can do something else. So I can occasionally perhaps throw the ball over the net and see if Anna wants to play tennis. So, for example, I was in Waitrose. I'm going through and the till lady said to me, did you have a good weekend? And I said to her, I had a fantastic weekend and my church meeting was great. So I just threw the ball over the net. The church meeting was great. And she immediately came back to me and said, really? Why was that? So now we can play tennis. And we passed the ball back and forth a little bit and then stopped. So this is just a kind of way to have conversations with people. And we have to think of what happens if we don't play tennis. I was on the tube, and because I'm a speaker, I need illustrations. And I have a kind of standing deal with the good Lord, is, you know, illustrations are helpful. So I'm on the railway, underground, London Underground, and I can see a couple having an argument. And they're about 20 people above me on an escalator. And they are having a big argument, blah, 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 blah. And I'm kind of nosy. So I'm thinking, I wonder what they're arguing about. And when I got close to them at the top, you know, you get sort of Constantined and you go through the kind of thing. And so we all got Constantined and I ended up standing very close to them. And he turned to her, and I think he'd already said this about 25 times. Yeah, I am dot, 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 that you were so late. And she said, it was not my fault. And he said, well, whose dot, dot fault was it that you were dot, dot so late? She said, it was the Christian's fault. Well, goodness gracious me, I couldn't have got closer. I'm right here. Yeah, I'm standing right there listening to this. So she said, well, what do you mean it was the Christian's fault? She said, well, I just went to the coffee machine and I just got a cup of coffee. And this bloke comes along and he's been at me for 15 minutes about, am I saved? Am I going to heaven? Do I love Jesus? Bloody, 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 blah. And that was more or less the end of the conversation that she had with him. So the question is, did our enthusiastic Christian friend leave this lady positive for the next Holy Spirit encounter? The answer to that question is no, he did not. Now, we admire his enthusiasm, but what he might have been better to have done is sensed the lady was busy and made her coffee. He would have been better to have not been doing words at that point at time. It just wasn't an appropriate moment, and obviously the rules of conversational tennis were not applying. So he left that lady less open, less positive, less wanting to engage than before he met her. And this is not the idea. So we've kind of just got to be sensible. C.S. Lewis said a strange thing. He said he was asked, what would heaven be like? And he said, well, heaven would be very polite. Which is quite a strange answer, really, until you think about it. And then when you think about it, you think it's actually a very clever answer. Because what he's saying is, in heaven you see people for who they really are, and therefore you treat them with respect. And so he said, in a strange way, heaven is going to be a very respectful place, a very polite place, hopefully a fun place, but a very polite place. And I think that's kind of a little bit of what we want to create down here on earth too. We want to be polite. We want to be gracious. We want to think about these things. We want to think about language. Think how I'm going to engage. I'm a member of a very old-fashioned gentleman's club in London. Now, this is not your silver pole type of club. With beautiful girls dancing. This is an old-fashioned club with leather armchairs and good food and quite a lot of alcohol. And it's a very, very small place. Very small place. Less than 3,000 members worldwide. Probably about 1,000 people using it in London. So if you enter into this world, you better think about your language and what you're going to say and who you are so that you can talk to people. But the last thing you want to know is, the last thing you want to be known is as a Bible basher. When I came back to England in 1974, I come from a fairly sort of middle class, upper middle class background, and my mantelpiece was full of beautiful invitations to lots of fancy parties. And, you know, all these fancy 21st balls and blah, 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 blah. And I spent one glorious summer going to all of these fancy parties, and I Bible bashed my way happily through the length and the breadth of Sussex. And if it moved and breathed, I Bible bashed it. And, of course, the inevitable happens that the next summer I didn't get a single invitation. There was kind of nary a one. So I sort of, in one wonderful moment, blew up my background and sort of created a forever void between myself and the sort of cultural background I'd come from, which I kind of occasionally had a bit of regret about. So when I am in my late 50s, mid-50s, I had an opportunity to step back into this background a little bit. So I did step back into this background, and I thought, well, as I step back in the context of this gentleman's club, I better think about language. So you've got to think about, okay, what am I going to talk about? And one of the complexities of the world today is that kind of every situation you're in needs a little bit of a different contextualization of language. So I talked to a friend of mine who is a street chaplain. So he's a chaplain to 150 houses on behalf of a church. He knocks on the door and he says, I'm your chaplain. Now, what is interesting is in this door, he's got an 84-year-old white lady who grew up in church and understands church language and church culture, and he can have a very old-fashioned churchy conversation with her. In the next door, he's got a young Asian mother who's an immigrant, been in England about 10 or 15 years, and it's a totally different conversation. In the next door, he's got someone else totally different, and he said to me that in this street, he has about 8 or 9 totally different cultural contexts to be thinking about, just in one street in England. And that is all of our experience really today, because we all live in a multicultural, pluralistic society. It's extremely different. So you can't have one size fits all, which makes talking complicated. So you've kind of got to be in your brain thinking about how to do this. So in this conversation, people come up to me all the time and they say, Lawrence, what do you do? Because this is what men do in clubs. They ask each other, sort of, what do you do? So I say to them, I am a church consultant and I help churches understand postmodern culture and how they could be relevant and how they could put over what their message is in a way that people understand. And they understand this entirely because they kind of understand postmodern culture. They're all trying to sell things or make things. They know all about this. And they say, oh, that's fantastic, Lawrence. Churches really need you. One of them went to his local church. He came back to me and he said, Lawrence, I went to my church and they, trust me, they really do need you. They are totally irrelevant. And I said to the vicar on the way out, my friend Lawrence at the club could help him. I said, I bet that blessed him. And so you have these conversations. And I talk to people often about church. So I worked out that these are kind of men in, and some women in their 40s and 50s, I'll talk about something neutral. So if they talk to me, I start by talking about church. I help churches. And the good thing about talking about church is it's kind of neutral. And it's just kind of out here a little bit. So I'm not talking about them. I'm presuming they're on side. I just say, I believe church is important. And the funny thing is, most of them say, yes, we agree. And so we have this quite positive conversation. And then they'll often ask me a personal question. And they'll come off church into a personal question. And you can kind of work your way through it. So you start talking about something neutral, then it becomes a bit more personal. And it's really interesting. So I'm quite well known at the club. The second thing that you do in most environments when you step in is you serve. I love books. I have quite a big personal library on the Second World War. So quite big. About 658 hardback books on the Second World War. So a reasonable size. Small by some. I have a friend who has a personal library of 25,000 books. 25,000, that's impressive. But I have 652, but I have read every one of them. So I love books, so I look after the club library. I love the library, it's on India, it's old, it's fabulous, it's wonderful, and I look after it. So I clean the books. So I always try to, when I step into a culture, try and serve. Not because I have to, but because I want to. And one of the things about this kind of conversation we're having this afternoon is it can look quite manipulative. So I have to tell you a process. When I tell you a process, I've kind of got to break down what is quite a natural chain for me. And when I break it down, it can look a bit kind of manufactured. So the ingredient that is really important is in your heart. When I wrote this book for the second time, I rewrote this book for the second time, I kind of went back to God and said, Lord, because I kind of have quite a polite relationship with God. I'm kind of formal at times. So I said, dear God, I'm rewriting Sowing, Reaping, Keeping. And if there was anything wrong with the first edition, which of course there wasn't, but if there was, then this is a good time to speak up. I've got some new material, so I'm going to write the new material and we'll just see what happens. So I'm happily writing this new material, but the more that I write the new material, the more uneasy I feel. And I'm kind of feeling like God's trying to talk to me about something. So I kind of re-engage and I say, well, dear Lord, are you saying there is something wrong with the book, the first book, fundamentally wrong? And I felt like there was. And in the end, I felt a little metaphor, a little thought come to my head. That you can take a horse to the water, but if it's not thirsty, it won't drink. And I felt like God said to me, Lawrence, evangelism isn't a method. It's not a method. It's a question. And I said, well, what's the question? He said, the question is, how big is your heart? This is not a method, a set of tricks. This is about, do you care about people? And I felt like he was trying to say to me that what I do and other people do a little bit sometimes is push people into methods. And I can push you into methods, and I can push churches into methods. But the trouble is, when I stop pushing, you'll stop doing. So pushing is fundamentally a waste of time. What would be better is if I could engage your heart. And if you have a big heart for people, then you're looking for ways to express that heart. So mission begins in the heart. John 3:16 says this, God so hated the world that he sent his son Jesus to judge the world and send as many people to hell as possible. Is that right? Is that what John 3:16 says? No? What does it say? John 3:16 says, God so loved the world that he sent his only son. So where does mission begin for God? It begins in the heart. And I think it's very important when we're thinking missionally, we need to think heart. So mission begins with engaging the heart, not activity. It begins, do I care about people? Do I care about them in the now? Do I care about them in eternity? Do I think they're important? And if I think they're important, then that needs to engage my heart, and therefore I reach out to them. So what I'm doing for people is not out of a methodology. It's not out of a sense of guilt. It's not because some evangelist told me to. It's not because the church leader wants the church to grow. It's because I fundamentally care about people. And I need to reach out to them on that basis. So I think that's very important about mission, that it begins here. And that I pray no prayer more than God give me a big heart for people. Because I've always struggled to listen to people. I've always struggled to kind of engage. I get self-absorbed very easily. So I've got to engage with God and say, God, give me a big heart. And sometimes we have kind of things that help us kind of work our way around. When I was a very young Christian, about 21 years old, I was living in this kind of Jesus community in Melbourne. And the leader of this community was the most amazing lady called Lorraine. And she was amazing for all sorts of reasons. She was a diabetic, an insulin-dependent diabetic, and she died when she was 33 because in those days insulin was very unsophisticated and you could only take it for 30 years. And she was born diabetic, so that limited her lifespan. I saw her one day with her syringe, putting it into her leg about here. And I noticed that to get the syringe in, she had to push really quite hard. And there was another girl in this Christian community called Barbara. And I said to Barbara, I don't know a lot about syringes, and I know absolutely nothing about diabetes, but I'm pretty sure you don't have to push syringes into your leg. I kind of think they're sharp enough to kind of go in. And she said, well, Lawrence, that would be right if you didn't use the same needle 100 times. Because you're giving all the money that you have for the needles to the poor and the needy. So Lorraine was very passionate about Christian things. And in my opinion, she had more passion than wisdom. But there we go. And I think there was a time when we had a generation of young people who had a lot of passion, too much passion in some way. So I used to buy her needles and give them one at a time. Because if I gave her the money, she'd give it away. So she was an amazing lady. And one of the things that she used to do, several things. One of the things that she'd do is she went to this block of slum flats and she'd knock on people's doors and she'd say, I've been sent by the authority to clean your flat, look after your children, do anything I can to help you. And people would say, yeah, well, great, come and do this and clean that. And then after a few kind of weeks or months, they'd say, what authority sent you? We'd like to thank the department that sent you to help us. And she said, well, King Jesus sent me. And I'm being sent by God. And she was called the Angel of Flemington. And in these, and they knew her as the angel who would go around caring for the poor and the needy. But because she had limited energy, I would often find her just collapsed because she was a diabetic and she wasn't in good shape. And the other thing that she did is she looked after a little gang. And this was a gang of 15-year-olds, sort of 12 to 15-year-olds. This was in 1972. And this was a real street gang. They were really feral. They were kind of scary. And they were doing things that I'd never even heard about. I can't, even today, I can't tell you the stories. You know, they were just unbelievable what they got up to, and very, very young. So she came to me one day and she said, Lawrence, I'd like you to look after the gang tomorrow night, kind of tomorrow afternoon. I do a thing with them, but I can't be there, so you're going to be in charge. So I kind of liked that thought. And she saw my eyes kind of twinkle. Lawrence, the boss, was kind of appealing. And she said, Lawrence, remember this, that whenever you're in charge, you give the example of love. And that's really kind of spoilt my life forever. I have a natural inclination to being in charge, and I have a natural inclination to enjoy being in charge. But Lorraine has forever spoilt it, because she said, Lawrence, remember, if you're in charge, you set the example of love. You show people what it is. You set the standard. And that is really challenging, and really, it has troubled me ever since she said it. So I try to live by that in some kind of way. Anyway, so she said, one of the boys is going to be very dirty. However dirty he is, don't clean him up or wash him up, because we believe his dirt is a kind of protection mechanism, and it stops his parents hitting him. oh, well, that can't be that difficult. So off I go. And we're in this little kind of environment, and the kids come in, and the kids go out, and the kids come in, and the kids go out. And eventually a little boy comes in, who I kind of think might be the little boy that Lorraine has in mind. And he kind of rushes up to me. And as he rushes up to me, I kind of rethink this dirt thing. Because what I realize is what Lorraine was really saying to me is this boy is soaked in urine. He's just soaked in it. His shorts are just soaked in urine. And when he gets really close to me, I realize his underwear is full of human excrement. And this little boy stinks to high heaven. Absolutely stinks. And he rushed up to me to be picked up. And I thought, you have got to be kidding. And I turned my back on the little boy and I walked away. And a few days later, probably the same night, but quite close to the experience, Lorraine saw I was a bit low, and she said, Lawrence, loving people is difficult, isn't it? And I said, no, Lorraine, loving people is not difficult. Loving people is impossible. How in God's name am I meant to do that? And she took me to a passage of scripture in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and showed me these verses. So it says this. Verse 14. Verse 15. He died for all. Lawrence, if you understand that God died for everybody, what you understand is the value of every human being is different. So if God dies for every human, then whether you're black or white, smelly or clean, you have value. And you base your behavior on the basis of their value. So you see them in a new way, you reach out to them in a new way. It goes on to say in verse 16, no longer then do we judge anyone by human standards. So Lawrence, don't look at the little boy from a human standard. Look to him from a different perspective. And then thirdly, make a choice. Christ died for all. He chooses. So I kind of meditated about, prayed about this. And a few weeks later, I found the little boy again. Same kind of thing happened again. But this time, by the grace of God, I was able to pick him up. Which wasn't a great experience, but I was able to pick him up. And I burst into tears because I think probably that was the first time in my life that I'd experienced sacrificial love. Sacrificial love is when you reach out beyond your emotions and feelings. And that is Christian love. Christian love begins when the feelings run out. So Jesus says that we're to love our enemies. What does he mean by that? He says even the heathen can love their friends. Everybody can love people they like. This is not difficult. To love people that love you, to love people like you, to love people who like you is really easy. What's difficult is to love people who smell or are different or awkward or odd or whatever it is. That's real love. Love begins when the feelings run out. And that's a fundamental life lesson, especially if you get married, because you won't always have positive feelings about your partner either. You know, I have a lovely Irish wife. I have her permission for this story. She has blue eyes to die for. But why are the Irish so stubborn? Yeah, it's quite difficult. And at times I have to go out and be really honest and say, God, thank you for my Irish wife, but this is darn hard work. You know, I don't find this easy. Help me. But real love, I've got to step. I'm a male, and sometimes I kind of want to impose, want to be kind of, I don't know. The answer is not very nice. And I have to face that and think, actually, real love begins when I live beyond that feeling. I don't do that feeling. I have a friend of mine, very intelligent, very clever, beautiful, beautiful wife. And he kind of has little wins all the time. He kind of puts her down. So I said to him one day, I said, Steve, why? Yeah, I know it makes you feel good, but you're paying a price for this. Trust me. It's not good. And I was very pleased. About a year later, I saw him again, and I noticed that he was doing it a lot less, and they were a lot happier. He said to me, thanks, Lawrence. He said, I don't know why I was doing that. I said, yeah, well, it's just human nature, isn't it? There's just that kind of bits in us sometimes that we're not as kind as, we just kind of feel like we want to do something. Well, real love, we've got to live beyond that. And that's what we call upon God to help us to do. Difficult. So that's the basis of our mission. Our basis of our mission is to live beyond. I was kind of thinking about these things when I was writing the book, and there was a knock on my door, and a man called Bob was outside my house. He said, I live in your road, and I've started a darts club at number one, and you're number 22. I'm looking for people who would join my darts club. Would you join my darts club with your good wife? So I thought, yeah, that would be a great thing to do. We'd get to know people. I'm kind of a bit isolated, you know, good mission stuff. Yeah, let's join the dance club. So we go down, and we're in a room, about kind of a third of this room, kind of going that way. And they've got darts. They've actually got a bar. It's a bit like a pub, but it's in a garage, and it's kind of secret. Anyway, so in we go, and we have a beer, and we play darts. But the only kind of odd thing is that there are eight people in there, and six of them smoked. And by the end of the evening, you couldn't see across the room, and I felt ill. I had not been in a real cigarette environment for a while. So when I came out feeling a little bit green, I said to the good Lord, I said, look, God, I'm your man. I'm going to be a secret pastor. I'd heard this guy called Ed Silvoso said, why doesn't every Christian think of themselves as a secret pastor? And their congregation is the unchurched. And you do the two things pastors do. You love people unconditionally, regardless of whether they respond or not. And yet you seek their spiritual welfare. So I thought, right, need to do this. So I need to be a secret pastor. And so I came back out and I prayed to God. I said, look, God, I'm really your person. I will be a secret pastor, but I've got one small request. I need a non-smoking congregation. And I felt like the windows of heaven opened up and God leant out from heaven and went, oh, poor little Lawrence, he doesn't feel well. Ah, oh, poor Lawrence, the smoky wokey went up his nosy wosy. And then I realized, of course, that hanging on a cross didn't feel very good either. So if Jesus could die for me, then I can sit in that smoke-filled room. And I sat in that smoke-filled room every Thursday night for 10 years. Every Thursday night for 10 years. Because these were my people. And how will they hear unless someone goes? How will they know unless they can see something of the reality? And did all 10 of them come to faith? No, they did not. Did they respond and understand more about Christianity? Yes, they did. But I didn't see revival or anything like it. But I did see a group of people engage with me and with God until Bob died. And sadly, my friend Bob did die after 10 years, and the pub stopped, the darts club stopped, which was a great shame, and I miss Bob to this day. So it's about your love. It's about that kind of interaction. So we want to speak. We want to give. We give of ourselves. We give of our friendship. We give of our hospitality. But we can also, at times, we give of our service, we can give things, books, materials. And one of the bits of research that we've done is to realize there are not many good things to give people. So when you look at Christian stuff, it's often kind of poor stuff. And you're thinking to yourself, well, why would I want to give it to people? So it's kind of a challenge to think of books. But there are lots of books that, some written by Christians, some written by non-Christians, that provoke spirituality. And these are good things to give people. Sometimes there's some things we can create. So some of you, last year we had the Queen's birthday. How many of you saw a little book that Hope did called The Queen and the King She Serves? You see that? So that was an idea. We sat down, we knew that it was the Queen's birthday. And we thought, what could we do to help the church be prepared for the Queen's birthday? And we had lots of discussions. And one day, a guy called Mark Green said, I've got all this material. I've got downloaded everything the Queen has ever said about her faith. Could we write it up in a book some way with lots of pictures? But we need the Queen's imprimatur. This kind of material is free to print because it's public domain material. However, unless the Queen signs it, it's not worth a light. So we thought, well, how do we get the Queen's signature? So Roy Crown, being a bit of an entrepreneur, he kind of wrote we did this in partnership with the Bible Society. The Queen is the patron of the Bible Society, so the Bible Society wrote to the Queen and said, Your Majesty, we're doing this project with Hope and with the LICC in London. Would you sign this? And to our amazement, she wrote back and said, Yes, I will. Now, we might have had another coincidence here. Roy Crown had a friend who had been an Anglican vicar, but he'd got into trouble and he had left the Anglican church and he'd kind of lost most of his friends, evangelical friends, except for Roy. And Roy has had lunch with this man for 2 years, for 2 times a year for 20 years. And Roy was seeing this, his friend, and telling him about his project. And this man looked at Roy and he said, Roy, you've never asked me for anything for 20 years, is that right? This man's very rich, very wealthy. And Roy said, no. And he said, you've always been my friend, even though lots of people haven't. And Roy said, well, that's because we're friends. And he said, okay, Roy, I'm going to help you. And Roy said, well, how are you going to help me? He said, my brother is the controller of the Queen's household. He sees the Queen privately, probably more than any other person alive other than the Duke. So I will mention the project to him, and he will mention it to the Queen. So maybe that's how it worked. Maybe that's not how it worked. I don't know. But anyway, we got permission, and we sold 1 million copies in 12 weeks because it was just fantastic and just a great thing to give people. So we're looking to kind of create a rhythm of mission. Now, what does a rhythm of mission look like? A rhythm of mission looks a bit like this. You can base your rhythm of mission on a number of things, and this rhythm is going to have two or three components in it. First of all, it's got your calendar, because we look to create something which doesn't change. So as far as I know, Christmas comes every year. Easter comes every year. Harvest comes every year. And we've got the summer down here. So you've got these fixed points. And we thought, what we need to do is create a rhythm for churches. What we don't want is if you have a new evangelistic initiative, what tends to happen is you build up the hype. You never kind of achieve what you hoped you would achieve, and it all gets a bit disappointing, and it's very difficult to do it again. But if you just create a rhythm that is with your church all the time, then it kind of gets easier. So what we propose is that every church has a guest service at Christmas. It's called a carol service. And in that, they can have 5 minutes to talk about the real meaning of Christmas. Every year we have an Easter service. We want to turn that into a guest service where we talk about Jesus, who he was, what he said, and what he did. And in the harvest, in the autumn, we want to have things like Christianity Explained, Christianity Explored, Alpha. We want to have some of these fantastic opportunities. So that is a little bit of a rhythm. We know these things are going to take place. And the third thing that we're hoping Christians is to be invitational. So we speak, we give, and we invitational. Jesus said, follow me. And we want to kind of invite people into our lives, invite people into our homes, invite people for cups of coffee, and yes, invite people into the activities of our church at times and is appropriate. So that's a little bit of the rhythm, but also I can put on top of this my talking. Now, you can play with this any way you like, but this is kind of what I do. So sometimes between autumn and Christmas, I talk about God a fair bit. And if people say to me, well, what's God really like? I can say, well, he's really like a man called Jesus. And we celebrate that at Christmas. And that's a good opportunity to invite people to a Christmas service. Between Christmas and Easter, could talk about Jesus. And people might say, well, Lawrence, what's he really like? And we can invite people to that Easter service where someone explains what Jesus is like, what he said and what he did. So God's story, Jesus' story, and between Easter and the summer, I can talk about my story. Not something that happened to me 30 years ago, but something that happened to me last week. I have a few health battles. I don't know why I'm blessed with health battles, but as I said, I ended up in hospital the other day. I ended up in hospital again the other day. I've also got a disintegrating neck disc. I'm not in good shape, and I'm a type 2 diabetic. So, you know, loads of things, niggly things. I'm not going to die from them, but they're not helpful. So lots of opportunities to kind of encounter God in the rough and tumble of life and hospitals, and it's all good fun. And it's all kind of amusing. And your stories need to be kind of real. I have other stories. You know, what am I going through? What's my story? And then that might give me an opportunity to ask people, what's your story? Now, one of the things about British culture is different from American culture. The Americans have been trying to teach us to do evangelism for 100 years. But Americans are a different culture. They are much more bold, and they have much lower levels of personal privacy. So they ask personal questions in America, like, how much money do you earn, or whatever. So I met a friend of mine called Chris. I hadn't seen him for about 10 years. And we're both in our early 60s. And he put his arm around me and he said, Lawrence, he said, we're both 60 now. I said, yeah, Chris, we're both 60. He said, Lawrence, can I ask you a personal question? So I foolishly said, of course, Chris, you can ask me a personal question. So he said to me, now, Lawrence, he said, how often do you and Ailish have sex these days? Okay, this is an interesting question. Because if I told him the answer, and Ailish found out that I told him the answer, I'd never have sex again. So, because as far as Ailish is concerned, that is entirely private. I thought I might discuss this with anybody, which he would be absolutely horrified. So you go, why did you ask me the question? We just don't ask these kind of questions. So in America, you ask people, would you like to give your life to Christ? Do you know Jesus is your personal savior? It's what they do, but it's not what we do. And that's why we like Alpha. That's why we like inviting people to things. Because we feel much happier. Would you like to know? Because we give them that kind of choice. We don't like it to be personal. So I have kind of thought in my head how I can ask a personal question without asking a personal question, if you see what I mean. And I think you can say to people, propositionally, what's your take on faith? So I can say to people in my club, actually, what do you think about faith? Do you have faith? Or is church important to you? And they really honestly, oh no, church is nothing to me, Lawrence. And that's great, it's a great discussion. Oh, really? So we're kind of thinking of ways to go around this, but that's one way. I can talk about God, I can talk about Jesus, talk about myself, I can ask them what their story is, what is they're going through. But I am looking to create this rhythm that the church embraces. And then what happens when the church has a rhythm of mission is that this is something that's reinforced. So let me tell you an example of this. So my friend David Smith runs a very big church, but don't worry about it being a big church because the principle works if it's a small church. So every year he talks from the pulpit about passion. Do we care about people? He creates an invitational culture and he has guest services. And there are about 1,000 people. And at their Easter service, they have 2,500 guests. That's a lot of guests. So that's like a church of 100 having 250 guests. Now, what does that mean? So it means on average, each church member is bringing 2 people. To bring 2 people, you have to invite 6 people. Probably, don't you, to get 2. So what does that tell us about the average church member of Kingsgate Community Church? Which is kind of perhaps a little bit different. What does it tell us about those members? It tells us they have lots of unchurched friends, isn't it? it tells us these are really connected people. It tells us they're no longer embarrassed about inviting people. And it tells us too that they've got confidence in the event that they're bringing the people to. So I'm going to be a bit naughty. I'll tell you a River Church story, a bit naughty story really. But years ago, I did an experiment with River Church. I wanted to get them into a culture of guest services. So I said, look, we're going to do a guest service. This is what it's going to be like. And we're going to do it to the church members. And we're going to promise them that the guest service, the next time we have one, is going to be exactly like what we've done, so they can have confidence to bring their friends. Following this so far? So everybody goes, yeah, that's a good idea. So that's what we do. And then we have a guest service, and they invite their friends. So then I say to the leaders, well, just go for it. So then we have the next guest service, which I didn't go to, foolishly, for various reasons, I was out speaking. And when I went, I said to the church members, what's it like? And they said, awful. I said, why? They said, well, Lawrence, it wasn't like you promised it would be. So this time, suddenly, in the middle of this guest service, not on the script, a whole bunch of extra things happened. So we had agreed the preacher would preach for half an hour, and he preached for an hour. We had agreed that we would be a bit careful about Holy Spirit things unless we really explained them. And they weren't really careful, and they didn't really explain them. And it was a disaster. And basically, they never had another guest service again in that way because people had lost confidence. There's no way people were going to bring their guests because they weren't confident on what the event would be like. This happened before you were born, so you don't know these people, a long time ago. So it's kind of important that what we do at church for our guest services is something that the whole congregation is happy with. So that you know that when you bring your guests, it is going to look more or less like this. We've all taken people to church, to guest meetings, and we've all lied. I've taken people to church and foolishly taking them to a particular meeting, and the preacher's still preaching, and we're 40 minutes in, and they turn to me and say, Lawrence, when will he end? And I say, soon. Well, I know that's not true. Yeah, I know that we've got at least another half an hour. And I'm thinking, oh God, this is awful. So it's really important that we kind of have confidence. And what David Smith does is a service that is very similar to his normal service, with a little bit tweaked, not a lot tweaked, but it is exactly as people expect it to be. So they know with absolute confidence that if they have a guest service, it will look more or less like this. It will live in certain rules. The worship will not be 60 minutes. The preaching will not be 60 minutes. They know something about the testimonies. David has funny rules. He's a kind of funny person. He does not like positive testimonies all the time. He doesn't want three testimonies of Christian rah-rah. So the first time I went, I had a testimony. And I had a guy, and he said, I'm an accountant, and I've been in jail for 8 years for fraud. And I came to faith in Alpha, and here I am. I'm in this church. And what you expected him to say was, and I've now got the most amazing job, and hallelujah, I'm earning more money than I've ever earned before, and life is good. But what he actually said is, I haven't had an interview for 2 years. I can't get a job for love nor money. Nobody wants to employ me. But God is important to me. And it was really powerful. So it was not positive, but it was real. And David has a positive testimony, but he has kind of little things so that people know exactly what it's going to look like. And whether he's doing the Easter service, he does one at Mother's Day, and he does about four a year. And loads of people come, and then he gives them an opportunity to kind of respond in the service, to talk to people, to join Alpha, all sorts of opportunities come out of that. But it creates this rhythm that is in the church. And churches that grow kind of have a rhythm and they connect things together. So if you've got a food bank, you engage in that food bank, you can invite people, you've got to be careful, but you can have literature, you can have invitations, you connect one event to the next event. So always looking for faith pathways. But loving people unconditionally, regardless of whether they respond or not, and yet giving them a pathway. So any questions on this? Does this kind of make sense? Any questions on a rhythm of mission, conversational tennis, kind of connecting people down, as it were?
It sounds very, like it's a very ancient way that the church has done mission and evangelism. Like if you look back in history, church was very linked to the seasons and, you know, irrigation Sundays. Mm. So where what people's lives were made up of was very rhythmical and seasonal.
Yeah, it's true.
And the church reflected that in what it taught and how its worship was. And it was more organic and sort of in rhythm with human life in a way, the nitty gritty of human life.
And I think we want it to seem a bit like that. And we want it to seem kind of natural so that I know and you know we have a common expectation. So I know that when I'm talking to my neighbour, if I want to and I think it's appropriate, I know that there's going to be a carol service I can invite them to. And so I did. So you can do carol services in lots of different ways. So we actually did a small carol service in a friend's house, and I invited my neighbour, and we raised some money for Tear Fund and blah, 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 blah. But you can do these things in different ways. Or you can do your big carol service, as David Smith does. But yes, I think it is like that. Good observation. Other questions or comments or thoughts? Yes?
Do you think it has to be like that to work? Like, if it wasn't psychical, do you think it would be a bit over the place?
Okay, you have to say that question. What has to be like?
It has to be a cycle for, like, not to work exactly, like not to, like, herd in people,
I think there are all sorts of things that can work. I think there's all sorts of creativity we can do. I think this is a piece of creativity. So I don't think it's the answer to anything, but I think it's a great place to start. Because it stops this kind of stop-start. You know, we just know that as a church, every Christian is going to speak, give, and invite. So that's what I'm going to do. We're all going to do it. And I also know that Vicky is going to make sure that these three things happen every year, and the team. So she knows that I will speak, give, and invite as appropriate, and I know that she will do this. So we have a common mutual understanding of how we can do an aspect. But other things can spring off this. So we talked about last year, we talked about the Queen's birthday. So you just fit it in. So the Queen's birthday is not in your natural rhythm. So, but we put it in for May, and that's a great opportunity. In 2018, we know that on November the 11th, Sunday, November the 11th, put it in your diary, the nation will do what on Sunday, November 11th, 2018, since the First World War ended? And what we know is that the government will do something absolutely spectacular. Did you see what they did in 2016 at the beginning of the Battle of the Somme? Did anybody see the men? Did anybody meet them? I wish I'd met them. I can't believe I didn't. So what the government did is secretly trained 20,000 actors to be a dead person from the First World War. They put them in uniforms, First World War uniforms, and spread them over the nation. And then people would see them and go up to them and ask them, who are you? And they would give them a card to say, I'm David Smith and I died today 100 years ago. Whoa, really powerful. And the government will do something in 2018. So we have a little committee of people, and we have met 3 or 4 times. So we're saying to ourselves, we know that's going to happen in 2018. So what could we do to be ready for that moment and have some resources for local churches? So that's a group of us are meeting now. So the Queen's booklet, you had to plan 2 years in advance. So we've got to plan 2 years in advance for this. So we have one idea, we have two ideas. King George V, on August the 8th, declared 100 days of prayer for peace. So we wonder if the Queen might do that. But she might not, because it might be government that does that. So we're kind of thinking about that. But we also know that the Archbishop of Canterbury has a... Only the Archbishop of Canterbury has this. The Church of England have a man whose job it is to think about services and prayers. So he is writing a prayer for the Archbishop of Canterbury to pray on November 11th, 2018. So he is writing that prayer now. So that's a lot of thought, isn't it? That's amazing. It's going to be an amazing prayer. And the Archbishop of Canterbury will pray that prayer for peace. So we have suggested that that prayer be put on a postcard with some kind of First World War picture on the front, and we print millions of them. And what will happen on November the 11th, 2018 is all church services will be around your local cenotaph. And everybody, all the churches will work together. And then we could give out the Archbishop's prayer and ask people to pray for peace themselves. That's just a thought. So we're looking for thoughts. So your rhythm of mission has got some basics that kind of stay the same. And then you might have a local thing. So you as a local village have your village fete, let us say, and you are invited every year. Well, you just put that in your rhythm of mission. So Englefield, it is Englefield, isn't it? Engle Green, fete. And that becomes a part of your church's rhythm of mission. That every year you're going to do something here because your village do it. So you've got the standard rhythm of mission that we all do, and then there's some national things, and then there are some local things that you do because your village does it or your street does it. So Eilish and I do something in our street every year. We have a personal rhythm of mission. We do something every year. Other questions or thoughts? It's a huge problem. So I think we have a loss of confidence in the gospel. We know that it works for us. We're not sure it works for anybody else. So I kind of have been addressing that by not addressing it, if you see what I mean, by just sort of going around the edges. But I think fundamentally that is a question that every Christian has to ask themselves. You know, do I believe that Christianity is good for other people? And I think that is, it's a hard personal question thing. So Justin Welby spoke out really quickly after he became Archbishop of Canterbury and said, I believe Jesus is the best thing that can happen to anybody. Yeah, he has total confidence that the gospel is important, and I have confidence. But I do think it's an issue. And that's part of your motivation. That's part of this heart thing. Part of the kind of getting a big heart is getting confidence. But it's a good thought. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you. It's been great to be here. So let's pray, and let's stand, and let me ask God to empower you and encourage you in these things. Heavenly Father, we've spent a good time looking at these things, and Lord, I just offer all these things back to you, and we want to be a genuinely big-hearted people that can reach out to your world with love and compassion, that we can do the word and we can do the deed and we can make a difference. And Lord, our world is a confusing, troubled place, but we just ask, Lord, that you would give us grace. We thank you for this 9% that is all over this country. We thank you that this 9% isn't on the whole enthusiastic. It on the whole wants to make a difference. And Lord, I pray that you would bless us and empower us as individuals to make a difference. And that in these next 2 to 3 years, we may see a door open over this nation and many people step towards Jesus. And we ask for this church that, Lord, by the power of your Spirit, we might grow. And Lord, we might see more people find you. And we ask these blessings and these anointings in the mighty name of Jesus. Amen. 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 Thank you.
Thank you. So we want to say a massive thank you to Lawrence for coming all this way to the Isle of Wight to speak to us. It's been really thought-provoking. And obviously we be chatting about all of this in our general conversation, but tomorrow morning, in the first session in the morning, we're going to be having a forum and we're going to be talking about what Lawrence has brought and what does that mean for us as a church. So that will be really good to talk together about that tomorrow. But it's free time now until 6 o'clock when there is dinner. And this evening we're going to be having, as well as of course the cabaret, Molly has now arrived. Woo! If you have a cabaret act,